chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to have in the middle of it. Rest make to have in the middle. We are rest make to have.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. Occurring this evening in Austin, Texas is The Great Awakening, and it's a fine movie on the pandemic and what really went on and how that was planned from a eugenic standpoint more than anything else. But that's happening here in Austin, Texas on June the 3rd, down at the Long Center, which is in the Dell Hall tonight. And I think it's a sellout. They gave away free tickets, but they also charged for some of them. So anyway, if anybody wants to go down there and still have time, go down there. Otherwise, I'll have click-offs on my site that you can go to and view the film at your leisure. But anyway, The Great Awakening, highly recommend you to view that. I think it's on YouTube. Also, the click-off is. The first clip I have is Dr. Ben Carson, interviewed by Joe Pags. Joe Pags is out of San Antonio, WOAI, one of the finest interviewers around. He's very conservative, but very fair-minded, and he asked Ben Carson some very, very probing questions, and Ben Carson comes back with some of the best answers that I've ever heard. He gets into Cloward Pibbins, how that has been used to break down America, and also the cognitive problems that people are having by this from this virus or this virus, you know, this vaccine. He talked about the amyloid fibers and things like that. He covers quite a bit in the time that's interviewed. But here we go with Dr. Ben Carson and Joe Pags.
Hey, thanks a lot for stopping by. Always a pleasure to have this man on. It is Dr. Ben Carson, of course, the former HUD secretary under President Trump. He's a world-renowned neurosurgeon as well and an all-around great guy. Ben, how are you? Good to see you.
I'm doing great, Joe. Always good to see you.
It's always a pleasure to have you on. I want to start somewhere a little bit off the beaten path. I don't want to get into some of the politics of the day, reparations talk, and are you going to run for president again, stuff like that. But I want to start with this. President Joe Biden physically has fallen up the stairs three times on Air Force One. He's tripped up the stairs and then didn't fall down. He tripped down the stairs in Japan, seems to have a problem getting around. He gets lost going into the White House. And yesterday we saw him face plant at the Air Force graduation. Now, the headlines that we're getting from the left media, Doc, are GOP pounces on Biden falling down and he tripped over a sandbag. When I think the headline should be, clearly in cognitive and physical decline, the president of the United States falls down again. What do you think is going on here?
Well, you know, people as they age have a lot of problems. Some people age well and some people do not. And, you know, the ones who do not age well, sometimes it's more than just their physical being. And you see a lot of memory problems, inability to think on their feet quickly.
Yeah.
Some of the manifestations that we're seeing now. The thing that's really more disturbing is that there are many on the left who are willing to excuse that, even though you know that it's putting our country at risk because they want to hold on to power. That's a very disturbing development. There was a time when we Americans wanted America to succeed.
Yes.
Now, broken down to a place where we just want our party to succeed.
Well, you and I have talked about this. You think his family is putting him at risk. You think the people surrounding him, they're using this guy who is a shell of his former self. Now, listen, I never agreed with Joe Biden. I think he's a bad guy. I think he might be a pedophile. I think he's got all sorts of issues about selling his office. But when he was cognitive, at least you could go at him. At this point, he's a shell.
Yeah, it's very sad. But, you know, I think if there's one person that I blame, it would be his wife. Because she knows about this. She's known about this for years. And it would be unusual torture to take someone you love and put them in a situation like that unless you had a motive, and your motive is to have power and fame.
AmericanCornerstone.org is the website. It's Dr. Ben Carson. Can you tell me and my audience the physical makeup of the brain before and after dementia? Is there a physical difference?
Well, the most common type of dementia, of course, is Alzheimer's. And, you know, the brain doesn't change its shape. But if you go at the microscopic level, you'll see what we call plaques and tangles and amyloid accumulations and things that demonstrate that there is definitely a problem going on there. And those things affect the transmission of impulses through the brain.
I mean, the only word that I even understood there was plaque. So if there is showing that you're that much smarter than I, but plaque, I would think would be something hard that would get in the way. And you said of transmission. So it's really a matter of the ability for you to send brain waves to wherever it has to go to control this motor skill or this pattern of speech. Is that really what it is? It's basically, it's hitting a wall and it can't get to where it needs to go.
It can't function the way that it normally does, as signals are not getting through in an appropriate way, unfortunately.
Let's talk about it politically a little bit, because, as you know, your former boss, the president, President Trump, they attacked him, 25th Amendment, he's not cognitive, he can't do this, he can't do that. He even took the test to prove that he was cognitively there. But they did this ruthlessly for four straight years. Now if you bring up a cognitive test about Biden, you're the devil on earth. I mean, Ben, why did they get away with that? Why did they get away with it with the double standard that this wasn't 100 years ago. This was 3 years ago we're talking about.
Well, Joe, you bring up a very important point. Why did they get away with all the various things that they're doing? Things that are absolutely outrageous. And our system was not designed for crooked people. You know, John Adams said, our system is designed for a moral and religious people. Well, yeah. We don't have moral and religious people, so it's not designed for that. So we got a real problem on our hands here. You know, when the Justice Department, you know, selectively administers justice, the whole system begins to break down. Confidence in the system breaks down. And unfortunately, that's what we're facing right now.
It's Dr. Ben Carson, founder and chairman of the American Cornerstone Institute. Go to AmericanCornerstone.org. Always great to talk with you. How did they do it so fast? Do you know, Doc? Because, and this is what I mean. Growing up, I knew about drag shows. Never wanted to go to one. I still have never been to one. I know that it's adult entertainment in a, you know, a darkened nightclub somewhere on Friday and Saturday night. How is it that they're reading to our kids? Why are they now having these so-called family-friendly or kid-friendly drag shows? Why has that permeated our society? And I guess we can add to that the fact that a label called Satan has a bunch of pride material that was in Target stores. They've now taken them out because people like you and me balked. But how did they do this so fast? All of a sudden I woke up and adult entertainment is for four-year-olds and Satan's making our clothing.
Well, it seems like they've done it fast, but they've been laying the foundation for quite some time. If you go back and you look at the congressional record for January 10, 1963, read into the congressional record were the goals of the Communist Party.
Wow.
Leon Skousen's book, The Naked Communist. And they have accomplished almost all of those goals now, including infiltrating our schools so that they could indoctrinate our kids, infiltrating the media so they could spoon feed the people only what they want to know and shield them for what they didn't want to know, removing God from the discourse, making people dependent on the government, dividing people, having them at each other's throat. All of these things written way back there, you know, 60 years ago, and they've been working on it the whole time. So we're seeing the manifestation of it at this point in time.
Well, how do we stop it? And it sounds like a very broad, general question, but again, I feel like it's sneaked up on us. I believe you. I think you're pulling January 10th, 1960-something out, so I'm going to believe you. Of course, you're telling the truth. But, I mean, back then we would have said, yeah, but that's ridiculous. We'll never do that here, whether it was read into the record or not. How did they end up doing it, and how do we undo it? I don't want to wait 60 years to fix it.
Well, you know, they don't care that we know, because they're counting on us doing what we have been doing recently and just standing in the corner with our head down hoping no one calls us a nasty name or tries to cancel us. So by fear and intimidation, that's how they intend to continue to do that. And I'm hopeful that maybe some of the people in Congress who are doing some of these investigations will be like bulldogs and will not just let it go like they always have in the past, because that is our only defense, you know, other than, you know, violence. We don't certainly want to advocate that. We need our representatives to stand up for what they believe and not allow this to go away. If the director of the FBI refuses to give them a document, they have to insist and they have to use whatever powers exist in order to get that document.
Yes.
Because they have oversight over the Department of Justice, and they should not just settle if the Justice Department says, no, you can't have it.
It's the wonderful Dr. Ben Carson. Go to AmericanCornerstone.org, AmericanCornerstone.org. Now, as a neurosurgeon, can you read my mind, Ben? Is that the story? Because I was just about to go there. I was just about to go right there. I want to bring up Kevin McCarthy. We, the American people, voted a Republican House, a generally very conservative, values-oriented House of Representatives. He offers up a deal to Biden and to Schumer that will avert any sort of default on the debt ceiling. Okay, we're not going to default on our debt. We're going to pay the debt. Gives them $1.5 trillion more, which I'm unhappy with, and then gets rid of the 87,000 IRS agents, gets rid of all this pork about $4 billion to build an FBI office, and then he capitulates. He just gives in completely when he sits down with Schumer and with Biden. So like you said, is he afraid of standing in the corner and being called a name? Because, Ben, they've been calling you and me names forever, but we've steadfastly stayed exactly where we believe. Why do you think the Republicans are so weak-kneed? Because this guy McCarthy spoke a good game to get that job, but he just gave in. He just got rolled by Hakeem Jeffries.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that we're going to add another $4 trillion to the national
debt. At least.
There comes a point where it becomes our number one financial obligation for the nation, just servicing the debt. It's number three right now. It's not going to be long at this rate for it to be number one. And that's going to have an incredibly powerful impact on future generations. I'm really kind of surprised that the young people, instead of running around saying, yes, we're going to get our debts alleviated, President Biden's going to do it, what they really should be worried about is what is going to happen to the quality of their lives.
Yes.
When half their paycheck or more is going to have to go to paying the national debt.
It's watching this unfold is crazy, because every time Republicans get leadership, they always capitulate. They always sit down and have the three martini lunch with the Democrats, and the Democrats get everything they want. Ben, you just had more Democrats in the House vote for this bill than Republicans. That should tell us everything we need to know. AmericanCornerstone.org is the website. Go there. It's Dr. Ben Carson. Let's talk about reparations, inequity, inequality, all this stuff. You had the left, who's still the left that they used to be. The Democrats were the ones that did all the bad stuff. Slavery, lynching, Jim Crow, separate but equal, the KKK, all, as you know, were Democrat policies. They're still the same party today. They claim they switched, they did something else. But here's a prime example. Gavin Newsom tells the people of California, I'm going to give you reparations. It's going to be great. The people of California said, great, give me some reparations. One guy wanted $200 million each. Literally went in front of some city hall and said, we want $200 million per person. And as soon as they said, okay, we're ready to take the reparations, what did Gavin Newsom do? What did Democrats do? I wasn't talking about money. We'll do it some other way. So, Ben, they're lying to them about reparations. They're lying to black people in America who aren't paying attention. Not you, not Dr. Swain, who I had on yesterday. You guys are paying attention, and you're great Americans. But they're preying on people who think, wow, I hear a payday. Let me go for that and vote for these Democrats. How do we wake up people in a community that are being lied to and have been lied to by the Democrats for hundreds of years? How do we wake them up to the fact that they're not telling you the truth, guys? They're not going to give you any money. They're not going to pay off your student loans. They just want you to vote for them.
Well, you know, we've known this for a long time from some of the recordings that were done of LBJ.
Yes.
We say, we'll give them these stuff and they'll vote for us for the next 200 years.
Sadly, he wasn't wrong.
No, he wasn't wrong. It's the same thing. Promise them anything. You don't have to give them anything, but just keep them hanging on. The good thing, though, Joe, is that there are a lot more people of color, and particularly black people, who are waking up.
Yes.
You know, I used to go to conservative functions and be the only black face. Far from that now. And that's encouraging. And I think as time goes on and people actually begin to see what's happening. I mean, you just look at the last administration during the Trump administration. all the incredible advances that were made on behalf of Black Americans.
Yes.
You know, you don't hear about them from the media because they don't want you to know about all these good things that were done.
Right.
But that will continue, you know, if we get another forward-thinking Republican in office.
Well, I'm with you, but how do people like in Chicago elect Brandon Johnson? Brandon Johnson, who literally is cool with 200 teenage Black boys and girls going and robbing anything, burning anything down, and his excuse is, these poor children don't have the opportunities they deserve. Please don't vilify them. Well, how are you ever, you're literally making a pack mentality, again, just to keep them voting for you. But how does Chicago not wake up after Lori Lightfoot? They hired somebody worse.
Well, it's hard to come up with a logical explanation for it, because there is no logical explanation for it. There are already people in Chicago calling, you know, for his recall.
You just had an opportunity to elect a guy who is a law enforcement guy who is going to go in there and clean things up. Ben, do you think that it's the white liberals that are voting these people in? I don't think that it's the young Black people necessarily voting for these idiots. Who's doing it?
I think a combination of them. You know, we have people who've been planning these things for a very long time. They're not going to give up easily. You know, chaos is part of the whole theory of how you change a society. You have to get people so frustrated with the status quo that they're willing to accept something new and something different. That's how a lot of dictators get into power. So part of it is you have to create chaos, and they're doing a good job of that, quite frankly. Cloward Piven, go look that up, talks about how you create so much chaos that people can't even orient themselves as to where it's all coming from.
I'm glad you brought that up. I had Grover Norquist on the other day specifically to talk about Cloward and Piven. A couple of pinhead college professors in the 60s came up with an idea of massive chaos and bankrupt the country. Once you bankrupt the country, and that's what they're doing by putting everybody on entitlements, by going $4 trillion more on the national debt, then you start all over. You just wipe the slate clean, and everybody has the same. Meritocracy doesn't matter in America anymore. You could not have succeeded like you have. I could not have succeeded like I have. We should all have the same car, the same food, the same clothing, the same housing, and we're all controlled by a bunch of elitists. That's really the goal here, isn't it?
And there's a lot more to this than just what we've talked about. They also have a goal of destroying our faith and destroying our families.
Why? Is that so the government can be God?
Exactly. That's why they're so hostile to religion in our country. And they want people to only depend on the government. And they're also in the process of dumbing people down. Our school system are failing. Fortunately, there's an explosion in homeschooling. It's doubled since 2020. And the lines for people to get into faith-based private schools is just interminable. And that's good because that means people are waking up. But right now we're up against the clock. You know, what can happen first? Will we wake up? Will we be courageous? Because you can't be the land of the free if you're not the home of the brave.
100%.
That's really the question here.
Go to the website right now. It's Dr. Ben Carson. I loved you as a candidate. I want to ask you quickly if you're going to run again. We'll talk about that in a second. Website is AmericanCornerstone.org. Executive Branch for America, is that what this is? EBA? What is EBA, Ben?
EBA is one of the programs of American Cornerstone.
Okay.
Institute. And basically it's the Executive Branch for America. And it teaches people, it's an online course that teaches people, free of charge, by the way, of how the government works. Particularly how the executive branch works, how all the agencies work, how they interact, how a bill is put forth, all those kinds of things, how the Office of Management and Budget works with the executive branch and with Congress.
I love this.
And the reason we do that is because most staffers, when they come to Washington, or even if they go to state legislators, they have no idea what's going on. They're like a deer caught in the headlights. It's very hard for them to be effective, because they don't know how things work for a year. And we're doing this so that people can hit the ground running. Because we also want to encourage conservatives and people who think the right way to go into government. Because if we all stand out and say, no, they'll tear me apart, they'll tear my family apart. If we all do that, what's left?
only the people tearing us apart. It's Dr. Ben Carson. Go to AmericanCornerstone.org. Find out about EBA. Find out about the book series also for children. Everything he does, go and consume. And, Doc, thanks so much for coming on today. I appreciate you.
Thanks, Joe. Good to be with you.
Okay. We're back after this. Stay right here.
That Joe Pags is one of the best. I mean, really gets down in there and digs down in and gets down to the bottom line so quickly. He's got so much energy, Joe Pags does. He's out of San Antonio, WOEI, Clear Channel, 50,000 watt station. And he's been there a while, but he really, he substitutes for different people over the years, some of the finest other broadcasters he sits in for, because they know that he'll do a fine job for them by sitting in. But his own program is one of the number one in the nation. But coming up next, we've got, last week we played a clip of Dr. David Martin at the International COVID Summit. It was hosted by the European Parliament. And we just played a clip of it. This time we're going to play the whole speech, and he really lays it on the line. And here we go with Dr. David Martin.
It is a particularly interesting location for me to be sitting today, given that over a decade ago I sat in this very chair right here in the European Union Parliament. And at that time I warned the world of what was coming. During that conversation that was hosted at the time by the Green and EFA and a number of the other parties of the European Union's various representations, we were having a conversation on whether Europe should adopt the United States policy of allowing for the patents on biologically derived materials. And at the time, I urged this body, and I urged people around the world, that the weaponization of nature against humanity had dire consequences. Tragically, I sit here today with that unfortunate line that I don't like to say, which I told you so. But the fact of the matter is, we're here not for a reprisal on past decisions. We're here to actually, once again, come to the face of the human condition and ask the question, who do we want to be? What do we want humanity to look like? And rather than seeing this as an exercise in futility, which is very easy from time to time when you're in the position I'm in, I actually see this not as an exercise in futility. I see this as one of the greatest opportunities that faces us, because we now have a public conversation, which is now front and center in people's minds. When this was an esoteric conversation about biological patents, nobody cared. But when that conversation came home, then it became something people can care about. So I'm actually quite grateful for this opportunity. I thank the members of Parliament for hosting this. I thank all of the translators who, I apologize in advance, I will use terminology that is probably very difficult to translate, so my apologies. And I'd also like to acknowledge the fact that many of you are aware of my involvement with this, in large part due to the amazing work of my wonderful wife, Kim Martin, who encouraged me at the very early days of this pandemic to get on front of the camera and talk about all the information that I had been sharing among very small groups around the world. And it was, in fact, her encouragement that put me in a place where many of you have heard what I have to say. Ironically, the world that I came from that used to be very popular, my CNBC and Bloomberg presentations, which were televised on mainstream media around the world, was an audience that I lost. I can confidently say COVID diminished my fame. But I can also confidently say that I'd rather stand among the people with whom I'm standing today than any of the folks that were part of that previous world. So this is a much better place to be. My role today is to set the stage for this conversation in a historical context, because this did not come in the last 3 years. This did not come in the last 5 or 6 years. This actually is an ongoing question that probably began here in Europe in the early stages of the mid-1900s, but certainly by 1913, 1914, this conversation started right here in Central Europe. The pandemic that we alleged to have happen in the last few years also did not happen overnight. In fact, the very specific pandemic using coronavirus began in a very different time. And we'll try to advance the slides here with one of these things. Oh, there we go. Most of you don't know that coronavirus as a model of a pathogen was isolated in 1965. Coronavirus was identified in 1965 as one of the first infectious replicatable viral models that could be used to modify a series of other experiences of the human condition. It was isolated once upon a time associated with the common cold. But what's particularly interesting about its isolation in 1965 was that it was immediately identified as a pathogen that could be used and modified for a whole host of reasons. And you heard me correctly. That was 1965. And by the way, these slides are public domain. You're welcome to look at every single reference. Every comment that I made is based on published material. So do make sure that you look at those references. But in 1966, the very first COV coronavirus model was used as a transatlantic biological experiment in human manipulation. And you heard the date, 1966. I hope you're getting the point of what I'm saying. This is not an overnight thing. This is actually something that's been long in the making. A year before I was born, we had the first transatlantic coronavirus data sharing experiment between the United States and the United Kingdom. And in 1967, the year I was born, we did the first human trials on inoculating people with modified coronavirus. Isn't that amazing? 56 years ago, the overnight success of a pathogen that's been 56 years in engineering. And I want that to chill with all of you. Where were we when we actually allowed, in violation of biological and chemical weapons treaties, where were we as a human civilization when we thought it was an acceptable thing to do to take a pathogen for the United States and infect the world with it? Where was that conversation? And what should have been that conversation in 1967? That conversation wasn't had. Ironically, the common cold was turned into a chimera in the 1970s. And in 1975, 1976, and 1977, we started figuring out how to modify coronavirus by putting it into different animals, pigs and dogs. And not surprisingly, by the time we got to 1990, we found out that coronavirus as an infectious agent was an industrial problem for two primary industries, the industries of dogs and pigs. Dog breeders and pigs found that coronavirus created gastrointestinal problems, and that became the basis for Pfizer's first spike protein vaccine patent filed, are you ready for this, in 1990. Did you hear what I just said? 1990. Operation Warp Speed? I'm sorry. Where's the warp and the speed? Pfizer, 1990, the very first spike protein vaccine for coronavirus. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't it fascinating that we were told that, well, the spike protein is a new thing. We just found out that that's the problem. No. As a matter of fact, we didn't just find out it was not just now the problem. We found that out in 1990 and filed the first patents on vaccines in 1990 for the spike protein of coronavirus. And who would have thought? Pfizer. Clearly the innocent organization that does nothing but promote human health. Clearly Pfizer. The organization that has not bought the votes in this chamber and in every chamber of every government around the world. Not that Pfizer. Certainly they wouldn't have had anything to do with this. But oh yes, they did. And in 1990, they found out that there was a problem with vaccines. They didn't work. You know why they didn't work? it turns out that coronavirus is a very malleable model. It transforms and it changes and it mutates over time. As a matter of fact, every publication on vaccines for coronavirus from 1990 until 2018, every single publication concluded that coronavirus escapes the vaccine impulse because it modifies and mutates too quickly for vaccines to be effective. And since 1990 to 2018, that is the published science, ladies and gentlemen. That's following the science. Following the science is their own indictment of their own programs that said it doesn't work. And there are thousands of publications to that effect, not a few hundred, and not paid for by pharmaceutical companies. These are publications that are independent scientific research that shows unequivocally, including efforts of the chimera modifications made by Ralph Baric in the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. All of them show vaccines do not work on coronavirus. That's the science. And that science has never been disputed. But then we had an interesting development in 2002. And this date is most important. Because in 2002, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, patented, and I quote, an infectious replication defective clone of coronavirus. Listen to those words, infectious replication defective. What does that phrase actually mean? For those of you not familiar with language, let me unpack it for you. Infectious replication defective means a weapon. It means something meant to target an individual, but not have collateral damage to other individuals. That's what infectious replication defective means. And that patent was filed in 2002 on work funded by NIAID's Anthony Fauci from 1999 to 2002. And that work, patented at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, mysteriously preceded SARS 1.0 by a year. Dave, are you suggesting that SARS 1.0 wasn't from a wet market in Wuhan? Are you suggesting it might have come from a laboratory in the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill? No, I'm not suggesting it. I'm telling you that's the facts. We engineered SARS. SARS is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. The naturally occurring phenomenon is called the common cold. It's called influenza-like illness. It's called gastroenteritis. That's the naturally occurring coronavirus. SARS is the research developed by humans weaponizing a life system model to actually attack human beings. And they patented it in 2002. And in 2003, giant surprise, the CDC filed the patent on coronavirus isolated from humans in violation, once again, of biological and chemical weapons treaties and laws that we have in the United States. And I'm very, very precise on this. The United States likes to talk about its rights and everything else and the rule of law and all the nonsense that we like to talk about. But we don't ratify treaties about, I don't know, defending humans. We conspicuously avoid that. We actually have a great track record of advocating for human rights and then denying them when it comes to actually being part of the international community, which is a slightly problematic thing. But let's get something very clear. When the CDC in April of 2003 filed the patent on SARS coronavirus isolated from humans, what did they do? They downloaded a sequence from China and filed a patent on it in the United States. Any of you familiar with biological and chemical weapons treaties knows that's a violation. That's a crime. That's not an innocent oops. That's a crime. And the United States Patent Office went as far as to reject that patent application on two occasions until the CDC decided to bribe the patent office to override the patent examiner to ultimately issue the patent in 2007 on SARS coronavirus. But let's not let that get away from us, because it turns out that the RT-PCR, which was the test that we allegedly were going to use to identify the risks associated with coronavirus, was actually identified as a bioterrorism threat by me in the European Union-sponsored events in 2002 and 2003, 20 years ago. That happened here in Brussels and across Europe. In 2005, this particular pathogen was specifically labeled as a bioterrorism and bioweapon platform technology. Described as such, that's not my terminology that I'm applying to it. It was actually described as a bioweapons platform technology in 2005. And from 2005 onwards, it was actually a biowarfare enabling agent, its official classification from 2005 forward. I don't know if that sounds like public health to you. Does it? Biological warfare enabling technology. That feels like not public health. That feels like not medicine. That feels like a weapon designed to take out humanity. That's what it feels like. And it feels like that because that's exactly what it is. We have been lured into believing that EcoHealth Alliance and DARPA and all of these organizations are what we should be pointing to. But we've been specifically requested to ignore the facts that over $10 billion have been funneled through black operations through the check of Anthony Fauci and a side-by-side ledger where NIAID has a balance sheet and next to it is a biodefense balance sheet equivalent dollar-for-dollar matching that no one in the media talks about. And it's been going on since 2005. Our gain-of-function moratorium, the moratorium that was supposed to freeze any efforts to do gain-of-function research. Conveniently, in the fall of 2014, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, received a letter from NIAID saying that while the gain-of-function moratorium on coronavirus in vivo should be suspended, because their grants had already been funded, they received an exemption. Did you hear what I just said? A biological weapons lab facility at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, received an exemption from the gain-of-function moratorium so that by 2016 we could publish the journal article that said SARS coronavirus is poised for human emergence in 2016. And what, you might ask, Dave, was the coronavirus poised for human emergence? It was WIV1, Wuhan Institute of Virology Virus 1. Poised for human emergence in 2016 at the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, such that by the time we get to 2017 and 2018, the following phrase entered into common parlance among the community. There is going to be an accidental or intentional release of a respiratory pathogen. The operative word, obviously, in that phrase, the word release. Does that sound like leak? Does that sound like a bat and a pangolin went into a bar in the Wuhan market and hung out and had sex and lo and behold, we got SARS-CoV-2? No. Accidental or intentional release of a respiratory pathogen was the terminology used, and four times in April of 2019, 7 months before the allegation of patient number one, four patent applications of Moderna were modified to include the term accidental or intentional release of a respiratory pathogen as the justification for making a vaccine for a thing that did not exist. Keep going. If you have not done so, please make sure that you make reference in every investigation to the premeditation nature of this, because it was in September of 2019 that the world was informed that we were going to have an accidental or intentional release of a respiratory pathogen so that by September 2020, there would be a worldwide acceptance of a universal vaccine template. That's their words right in front of you on the screen. The intent was to get the world to accept a universal vaccine template, and the intent was to use coronavirus to get there. And the last slide. This isn't advancing, so if I could have somebody advance. Let's read this, because we have to read this into the record everywhere I go. Until an infectious disease crisis is very real, present, and at the emergency threshold, it is often largely ignored. To sustain the funding base beyond the crisis, he said, we need to increase the public understanding for the need for medical countermeasures such as a pan-influenza or pan-coronavirus vaccine. A key driver is the media, and the economics will follow the hype. We need to use that hype to our advantage to get to the real issues. Investors will respond if they see profit at the end of the process. Sounds like public health? Sounds like the best of humanity? No, ladies and gentlemen, this was premeditated domestic terrorism stated at the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2015, published in front of them. This is an act of biological and chemical warfare perpetrated on the human race, and it was admitted to in writing that this was a financial heist and a financial fraud. Investors will follow if they see profit at the end of the process. Let me conclude by making five very brief recommendations. The last slide. Nature was hijacked. This whole story started in 1965 when we decided to hijack a natural model and decide to start manipulating it. Science was hijacked when the only questions that could be asked were questions authorized under the patent protection of the CDC, the FDA, the NIH, and their equivalent organizations around the world. We didn't have independent science. We had hijacked science. And unfortunately, there was no moral oversight in violation of all of the codes that we stand for. There was no independent, financially disinterested, independent review board ever impaneled around coronavirus, not once. Not once. Not since 1965. We do not have a single independent IRB ever impaneled around coronavirus. So morality was suspended for medical countermeasures. And ultimately, humanity was lost because we decided to allow it to happen. Our job today is to say no more gain-of-function research, period. No more weaponization of nature, period. And most importantly, no more corporate patronage of science for their own self-interest unless they assume 100% product liability for every injury and every death that they maintain. Thank you very much.
Our third clip this evening is, we're having extended clips of this go-around, is Chip Roy, okay? And Chip Roy really got upset when this debt limit bill was passed by the House and forwarded over to the Senate. They passed it, and now the president is taking all kinds of credit for getting this thing done. But anyway, he was interviewed on the Dan Bongino program, and here's an extended, what he had to say really was a disappointment in the whole bill, and here's why that bill, in his opinion, should have never been passed. Here we go with Chip Roy.
Back to pass this, quote, deal. Man, what a deal.
Well, tell us about this deal.
Well, it's garbage. Let's be very blunt. It was not worth the paper it's written on. My Republican colleagues who are out pimping the deal should stop it. They're going to have egg on their face as history looks at this and reviews that the American people are the ones who got hosed. $4 trillion of additional debt, $4 trillion, for what you can best say was a two-year spending freeze, literally, a two-year spending freeze. And frankly, it's not even that good, because when you look at through all the smoke and mirrors, and you've got, we reclaimed COVID money. No, you didn't. You had $28 billion of COVID money. You took $6 billion, and those $6 billion were then actually set aside, but $22 billion were put over the Department of Commerce for additional spending in the future out of the Department of Commerce. You've got other dollars that they are going to play with, like IRS money. They say, we took care of the IRS. Well, $1.4 billion is all that they've allegedly cut. And then they say, don't worry, we'll take a little bit more of that money out of IRS money to do what? To go hire more bureaucrats than the rest of the government. Look, they tried to say that we have work requirements, but then the CBO scored it and said we actually expanded the cost because we expanded the population of people who would get benefits under SNAP, TANF, and so forth. This is all smoke and mirrors. It's the Washington game at its worst. The American people are the ones left holding the bag. The only thing I will say is you had 71, really 72, because Warren Boebert couldn't make it to the floor. 72 people opposed this bill on the floor of the House. You had 31 Republicans oppose it on the floor of the Senate. And I think it's very clear that this was a Democrat-centric bill, based on their now pretty much taking a victory lap the last 48 hours.
Well, they do have some people, you know, like, for instance, I think you're probably one of the most principled people in the House, but so is Congressman Thomas Massie, is someone I deeply respect and I earned a ton of respect for during COVID for being so bold. He voted for it, and he said that this is, you know, he's been in Congress for a decade, and this is the first real bill that cuts spending.
Well, Thomas is wrong. I love Thomas. But when you say it cuts spending, one, you've got mandatory spending continuing to go up. Number two, again, with the smoke and mirrors, I don't believe this actually cuts spending. I think it's at best a break even for 2 years. And then third, when you say that it cuts spending, oh, isn't that great? It's cutting the rate of growth in the end. That's all we're getting out of this deal. And with all due respect, when we set out to do this, right, the purpose here was to actually have a trajectory shift against a Democrat regime that is actually destroying our country, right? So why are we going to just sit down and take peanuts? They continue their entire radical green agenda, completely left intact. The Democrats come in charge, come in power during President Trump's regime. What do we get? Impeachment. They went to war with the Trump regime. What do? We sit back and we beg for crumbs. It's absolutely astounding to me that my colleagues will stand up and defend a bill that will extend the debt ceiling. Okay? I want everybody to understand that. $4 trillion. Say it out loud. I'd like anybody to come defend. $4 trillion. When you leave the Green New Deal intact, you get no real work requirements, you get at best a spending freeze for 2 years, which in the end will probably be blown up during the appropriations process because the same fools who cut the deal will cut a deal in the fall when the defense hawks say, oh, sorry, we need more money for defense.
But, you know, I'm sure you'll people like, you know, Speaker McCarthy say, oh, well, you know, we've got one body. You know, we only have the House, right? We're working against a Democrat-controlled Senate, a Democrat president. You know, what would you say to that?
We were winning the polls by sticking to the plan that was agreed to in January. We agreed to spending levels at 2022. And we were working down that path, just like we did when we passed the Limit, Save, Grow Act, just like we did when we passed the border bill. And look, I was happy to sit in a room and work and figure out how we could negotiate with our friends and colleagues, have different views across the conference. But now you go in and you go and cut a deal with the Democrats. And explain this to me, Lisa. Ask Kevin. Ask any of the people who voted for this bill. Why is it that Democrats are out praising the bill? Why is it that there were 46 Democrats in the Senate who voted for it and only 17 Republicans in the Senate? Why is it that more Democrats voted for the bill than Republicans in the House? Why did 71 Republicans vote against it on the floor compared to 40-something Democrats? Somebody explain to me why the Biden White House is out going, hey, this preserves our whole Green New Deal. Hey, don't worry. We can waive all of the so-called administrative regulatory reforms. Of course they can. They get the joke. Democrats play for keeps. We play for crumbs. We're tired of it. That's why we tried to set a deal in January. That deal was not followed, so now we got to get back to the table and figure out what we're going to do.
You know, if you're just tuning in, I'm Lisa Booth filling in for Dan Bongino. We've got Congressman Chip Roy with the great state of Texas on the line here. You know, Congressman, it does feel like, you know, I was supposed to talk about this on Fox News one day, and, you know, producer asked me my thoughts, and I said, you know what, like, it just all seems like BS to me because both parties spend so much money, and it seems like the fight isn't ever over the spending. It's over what we spend the money on.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. I mean, honestly, and that cuts to the chase, like, if you go look at the no votes among Senate Republicans, kind of half, I don't know if it's exactly half, but a chunk was from the fiscal conservative perspective. The other chunk, or half, was from the defense hawks who didn't think it was good enough to spend more money on defense. Look, here's the thing. We're either serious about dealing with spending or we're not. I would ask all my colleagues who couldn't muster the courage to simply return our spending to pre-COVID levels for the bureaucracy, for the non-defense bureaucracy, I would ask them, how are you going to deal with mandatory spending? Social Security, Medicare, deal with burn pits in the VA. How are you going to deal with all of that stuff on autopilot if you don't even have the courage to go cut the freaking FBI? Like, come on. Seriously. Like, Republicans will always find a reason to figure out how not to do their job. Democrats play for keeps. We end up with the radical new Green Deal. You understand that the subsidies put in place last August will completely decimate the American grid and our ability to produce reliable energy? And Republicans are just whistling past the graveyard. They're just like, oh, look at us. We got a spending freeze. Pat me on the back. The Wall Street Journal is happy. They love me because we didn't default. And all of my donors from Wall Street, they love me. Meanwhile, the hardworking plumber in San Marcos, Texas is saying, what the hell? What happened to the American dream? That's what's going on, Lisa.
Do you think that's what it is? Because I agree with you. You know, Democrats play for keeps, and it does seem like too many Republicans, you know, want that pat on the head. They want to be invited to the dinner parties. They want, you know what I mean? They want to be, quote unquote, socially acceptable, right? Is that what's behind it? Is that why Democrats play for keeps and we don't?
I think so. I mean, let me just tell you the reaction in the last 48 hours.
Yeah.
I had multiple people on an airplane flying back to Texas that I don't know from Adam pull me aside and shake my hand and thank me. They're not my constituents. They just said thank you. Thank you for fighting. Had a guy from Providence, Rhode Island, coming down for like a strongest man competition. Remember the old ESPN? They used to throw the kegs over the walls and stuff. It's one of those deals. It was awesome. These guys were great. Anyway, the guy goes, hey, wait, I think I know you. I go, uh-oh. He goes, I saw you on TV a lot last couple of days. Hey, you gave a great speech. Thank you. Man, they screw us, don't they? I'm like, yes, they do. They do. And you know what? The only people complaining to me, three or four donors who sent in their little form with a black X on it saying, hey, if you don't stick with leadership, count me out. Don't send me another money request. And a Wall Street Journal, which they've never met a deal they didn't love, that ultimately walked away from the actual fight so long as it preserved their, you know, financial, you know, sensibilities of all the finance networks in New York, right? Those are the people that are talking about how, you know, oh, look at how great this deal was. The average American is going, what the hell? $4 trillion, and what did I get?
Yeah, I mean, I think that seems to be sort of a consistent theme where people feel like, you know, the folks in D.C. don't really care about them. You know, we see Republicans sell people out on, you know, Second Amendment and, you know, things that they're supposed to be fighting for us on. You know, before we go, I wanted to shift gears real quick and get your take on, you know, this whole fight with Christopher Wray, you know, James Comer, obviously, you know, drafting legislation to hold FBI Director Christopher Wray in contempt of Congress. The fight is over classified information related to Joe Biden when he was vice president. How do you think this will play out? And what does this tell you about Christopher Wray and the FBI right now?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, it tells you everything you need to know. What we're seeing is we're actually seeing the facts. We know the truth. We know what's going on with the Biden laptop. We know what's going on with the Biden family and their entire corruption. The American people see it. Wray wants to obviously obfuscate it. And here's the question. Will Congress use the power of the purse to demand that they do what they're supposed to do? I mean, we can pass whatever we want. We can tell them they got to, you know, follow a subpoena. But if we're not willing to say, guys, you're not getting a dollar over the FBI until you actually do what Congress is telling you to do, right? That until we do that, then we have no real authority, right? They're not going to listen to us. They just laugh at us. So we'll see what happens during the appropriations process. And one other point, you mentioned the Second Amendment. Andrew Clyde just broke some news, I think, on Steve Bannon's War Room, where he said he was called on Wednesday and threatened that his great bill, the Congressional Review Act, to say that we need to repeal and stop the Biden rule on the pistol braces, right?
Yeah.
We'll make felons out of 10 million plus Americans. He has a bill that would do that. It was on the calendar. It was supposed to come up this week. And he was told by leadership, you vote against the rule, we're going to stop that. And we're going to tell the Senate they should take the lead. So now we got to wait and see what's going to happen. But they might risk our ability to move a really important piece of legislation to protect millions of Americans' constitutional rights because of petty Washington internal politics. That's the swamp.
It is the swamp. You know, real quick, what should we do with the FBI? If we get another Republican in office, obviously there's going to be a lot of obstacles in the way. But, you know, what should be done with the FBI?
I think there are two concrete proposals that we're looking at, one of which is probably the easiest thing is to at least return the FBI back to pre-9/11 non-domestic terrorism duties. In other words, the FBI, to the extent that it had any usefulness prior to that, you know, it's just sticking to its core job of working about, you know, interstate crime, you know, looking at organized crime across, you know, states. You know, they should be looking at human trafficking. They should be, you know, looking at the trafficking of illegal firearms across the country, you know, actual legal firearms. You know, they should be looking at, you know, the massive fentanyl, you know, scourge going on, China's involvement with it. Instead, they're trying to make a domestic terrorist out of Scott Smith. Instead, they refuse to work with us about going after and seeing what the Biden family is actually doing. So, look, I think we ought to return to the sort of pre-9/11 version of the FBI. The second thing you could do is break them up a bit. You know, you could kind of more regionalize it and make it more akin to the United States Attorney's offices, right? So they don't have as much centralized authority. Allow them to coordinate information flow, but frankly, attach more of those investigative duties to the local U.S. Attorney's offices or something along those lines. I think there's a couple different models, but we need to take a real long, hard look at the FBI.
I absolutely agree. Those are good solutions for something for us to look at. Congressman Shipoy, as always, I appreciate your time. I know you're a busy man. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us on this Friday. Hope you have a great
always
day.
Always happy to do it, Lisa. Always happy to join you, Dan, or any of the other great folks that are out there. You know.
That concludes our program of this evening. I'm going to make a few short comments here. But anyway, the Ben Carson interview by Joe Pags got into communism, on how communism is taking over our country. And by gosh, we really got to look at this. And I'll have a list of those characteristics of communism. I'll put those up on our site. And I'll do some, also click also on Clover Pivens and so forth, and other hypertext links that'll help you to understand what's really going on out here. And what's really going on out here is a takedown of this country in one way or another. And it's getting very, very serious, and I'm really worried about it. And these changes that are occurring at an unprecedented rate in the last few years, especially under the Joe Biden administration, the debt that has been created, my gosh, into the trillions. And we just can't continue to mount that debt up and have a good outcome. Just the interest on it is going to be unpayable, you know? So we're headed into a really downward spiral. And this communist movement is getting worse all the time in the country. And it's a controlled opposition by the corporate fascists out there, and being funded through the Tides Foundation, the Tides Center, and so forth. I've been studying this for decades, and I had to go in and dig down into some of those sites and of some of these organizations, very left-wing. And they're very idealistic, and they think that they're going to help bring about communist state. And they're being funded all the time by these corporate fascists that are, you know, putting the money through the Tides and other people like that, organizations to bring about a new world order and to take down the America that we highly valued and were so proud of all the time, and trying to create something that is very like a monster. This is very monstrous. We've got all kinds of debased happenings going on, and it is just terrible. And I can't express my anger and my disappointment, my sadness when I see what's going on to our country out here. But thank you very much. Good night, and God bless each one of you.